Welcome to the Cold Steel Podcast, hosted by Amir Farouk and myself, Chad Ball. We consider it an absolute privilege to bring you guests from around the world who are truly experts in their craft. Our mission is to offer you a combination of not only masterclasses on clinical surgery topics, but also insights into achieving personal growth, productivity, and fulfillment as both a surgeon and perhaps more importantly, as a human.
Welcome, everyone, to a special episode of Cold Steel. We're very happy to put out this episode, which is another episode of mock oral exams. And we were quite lucky this time to actually be the beneficiaries of the AAGS conference, which is the Alberta Association of General Surgeons conference that was held back in November of 2021 this year. It's an annual conference that's held every year in Alberta. And as part of that conference, Dr. Liz Clement, who is actually one of the colorectal fellows here at UBC and a former resident from the U of A program, put together a session of mock oral exams for a bunch of the senior residents who are attending AAGS, as we really feel that it's, you know, as much practice as possible for these senior residents. It's just going to do them in good stead. And so once again, thank you to AAGS for allowing us to use their space and some time during the conference to do the mock orals. And thank you to Dr. Elizabeth Clement for putting this all together and really figuring out the logistics of everything and making it happen and allowing us to use some recordings for mock orals. And thank you to all the examiners who were all the surgeons from both Edmonton and Calgary. You know, thank you to all the residents as well who volunteered to actually be recorded. You know, this is a very brave thing to do, is to put your necks out there and be recorded and also be examined when you know the stakes aren't really as high for them yet. You know, most of the residents actually that we have recorded are fourth year residents, so they're not in their fifth year, not really in the throes of their exams, but they're brave enough and really thoughtful enough to actually put themselves out there and go for it. I thought this would be a good time, Dr. Ball, to just go through some examinership techniques again, particularly thinking about the mock orals. What are some of the important tips and methodology tricks that you give to people when preparing for their oral exams?
Yeah, thanks so much, Amir, for the question. I agree. We should really thank the residents that were willing to put themselves out there and, you know, to an international audience. And, you know, we intentionally, I think it's safe to say, have not over-edited this in any way. We wanted it to be raw, and we wanted, you know, really all trainees across Canada and elsewhere to think about how these residents, candidates answered questions, what they thought was good, what they thought was bad, where they thought they would improve. Really the same process that each of the residents got in terms of feedback. So really kudos to them. You know, as far as sort of organizing your thoughts and coming to an exam with a strong presentation and a really good performance, I would also encourage our listeners to go back to episode number 10 of Cold Steel and just revisit our interview that you and I did with Tony McLean, who, you know, is the current chief of the Royal College Examining Committee here in Canada. Obviously, he didn't go through any specific scenarios, because of course he can't, but he did give us some pretty broad insights into examsmanship and what really matters. So, you know, a lot of my thoughts, being trained by Tony long ago and being around him every day, come from guys like him, and preceding that, Don Bowie and other folks that have been involved with the Royal College for a long time. So, I think that the exam clearly has changed a lot over the years. It's quite focused. And I think one of the biggest surprises probably to candidates, and you could speak to this having done it not too long ago, Amir, is the relatively rapid pace and focused nature of it. Hey,
you know, might as well get the jokes out there right off the hop. I actually was the special year that didn't have a oral exam. So yes, go ahead, say all the jokes about the FRCSC-W. But yes, you know, in even doing some of the, you know, seeing how these oral exams are put together or practicing them, they go by really fast. And so you really have to have an organized approach and a thought process on how you're going to tackle and attack these oral exams.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, and in terms of things that probably set off or are seen as negatives to the actual examiner, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is just be physically and verbally humble. Be respectful of the process. Be uber respectful of the examiner's time and their willingness to take, you know, and traditionally in Canada anyway, a week off work to go to the Ottawa facility and do these oral exams. You don't want to walk in with too much bravado, and certainly don't want to be interpreted as arrogant. So that's, you know, that's probably not a problem for most folks, but it certainly is for some. And then you're right. The second thing is really to be organized, to present your thoughts in an organized, linear way that shows that you really have prepared well. I think candidates that sort of jump around and seem a little bit confused, probably more than anything, you know, that can certainly put off examiners. There's really no doubt about that. The reality, though, you know, as you probably know as well, Amir, is the examiners are there to not only examine you, obviously, for content and knowledge, but they're there to help you. And the exam really has changed significantly in Canada to try and allow them, you know, if you do start to come off the appropriate pathway to help you and nudge you back onto it. And, you know, they really are quite skilled at that at a very high level.
Dr. Ball, do you have any specific ideas or tricks that you give people to, like, kind of get themselves back on track if they start to come off the rails? You know, for example, some people are fans of summarizing the case, especially after kind of you've had the history and physical component. You know, often, not every scenario, I think, is going to be like this, but often you'll kind of get the history and the physical, and then you'll have to come up with a differential and a plan. You know, I've certainly heard people talk about kind of summarizing the case. Are you a fan of that? Are there any other particular strategies that you tell people if they're kind of getting confused or if they feel like they're kind of losing track and focus during their scenario?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, the summarization technique can be helpful, I think, to kind of buy you time and organize your thoughts a bit and show some organization to the examiner. But you certainly don't want to perseverate on it. And that's probably for two reasons. One is, again, the exam does have to move forward relatively rapidly. So you don't want to waste anybody's time, i.e. the examiner's time. The second thing is you certainly don't want to provide an overly long summary. You want to, more to the point, you know, show you've been listening, show you're engaged, show you've assimilated that information, but I certainly wouldn't spend too much time on it. Two things come to mind maybe in closing. The first is that, you know, my recommendation to anybody, particularly if you're doing fellowships in the U.S., is to do the American board exams as well. And there's lots of different reasons for that, but one is to be truthful. You know, it's really quite fun, and the process on the oral side, the oral examination side, is very, very different, and the experience is very different. Their exam is certainly dictated by areas and domains that they have to ask you about, but it's much more the Wild West, and it's much more an exam like, you know, Canada used to be. And really that does highlight the structured, reasonable nature of the Canadian exam. There's no doubt. The other thing I would say is that, you know, a lot of people, whether they are naturally verbally strong or good at presentations, for example, at research meetings, don't necessarily examine well. And I would say that I was probably in that descriptor, and at my stage, you know, as a resident as well. What's great, though, and what the reality is, that shouldn't hold anybody back, and it shouldn't discourage any trainee. You can get as good as you need to and become infinitely better just by practice. So grab your local faculty, grab recent graduates, grab your fellows, grab anybody you can, and just keep practicing. Start early, try and do it. You know, don't leave it to the last 3 or 4 months. Work on it gradually. You know, as you can see, as you'll hear, I should say, these fourth year residents that did this did a marvelous job. And I, you know, thinking back to it, I think they're far ahead of where I was in terms of examination skills in my fourth year. So don't be discouraged. The content will come with work and effort. but it's really the process and the examinership skills that I think are not natural to a lot of us, but can be learned just by drilling over and over again.
And the one editorial note I'll also make, Dr. Ball, is that I feel like in preparing for the exam in general, first of all, you benefit, again, so much from just reading cover to cover these textbooks, really getting into the minutiae of this data. And it's surprising how often, you know, you'll see some crazily, what you thought was such a minutiae type esoteric fact show up in real life. You know, Zushka's disease, some breast disease that, you know, I thought I would never see in real life. And yet one day on call, you'll see it. So that's one thing, is that the exam really does help shore up your knowledge. And I think in particular for the oral exam, it's funny how, you know, you rehearsing for the spiel that you're going to give. This is how I would do a trauma laparotomy. It's funny how those, that mantras and those scripts that you ran in your mind for the exam suddenly appear and bubble up through the surface of your mind when you're actually faced with a real life scenario and you're suddenly like, okay, what do I need to do? And your adrenaline is kicking in and you're feeling that fight or flight reaction. You can't remember anything. Suddenly these scripts start to bubble up through your mind. So, you know, I really do think beyond the exam, I think the studying that you do for this is really quite beneficial. It's not like, you know, many of the exams we've taken up until this point where, you know, you memorize things and then you forget them. These things really do matter and are very helpful.
It's important to just make one disclaimer that we are not officially affiliated with the Royal College exam, and these are simulated scenarios and may not represent exactly the type of format that you might see on the Royal College. And really, these are more about getting familiar with the mock oral scenario and style as opposed to precise content from these scenarios.
So you referred a 40-year-old who's recently found to be BRCA positive. She's unsure what this means and would like to know about her risk of cancer. So what are you going to say to her?
I tell this young woman who is recently found to be BRCA positive that she carries a gene that increases her risk of developing breast cancer in addition to other cancers like ovarian cancer as well. It doesn't mean that she will develop cancer for sure, but this is something that runs in her family, and her risk of developing cancer is higher than the general population risk of developing cancer.
Okay, and then you mentioned, did you say anything about percentages, or do you know that?
I didn't say anything about percentages. I will let her know that because of the fact that she's BRCA1 positive, she'll have to start screening for cancers at an earlier age. Yeah. Okay. I'll have to look up the percentages.
Okay. Good. Just let me see if I can get this to go to the next slide. There. So, okay, so you talked to her about the risk. That's good. And then now we're going to tell her about options for this risk reduction. So how are you going to counsel her on what to do next?
In terms of risk reduction for breast cancer for her, I would counsel her that we would recommend that she start screening at an earlier age than general population for the development of breast cancer. We would use the usual modalities, including screening mammography to screen her for breast cancer, and that the other option that would be available to her, given that she is a high risk, would be prophylactic surgery to reduce her risk of developing cancer in the future.
Okay, sorry, so what surgery did you tell her? What should she have?
A prophylactic bilateral mastectomy.
Okay. So those are your options, with surgery or surveillance?
Surveillance for you, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so now what do you tell her? She says, well, what's my best option? What do you say?
I would tell her that, you know, I would have to consult with one of my breast surgery colleagues who sees this more regularly to tell her which option is better. And that, you know, it would be a personal choice for her if she was willing to have the risk or undergo the risk of having the prophylactic bilateral mastectomy. It would be reasonable and I would suspect equivalent to having screening for breast cancer and then dealing with a malignancy if it arises, and we could catch it early with short screening intervals.
Okay. Okay, so let's say she, after you tell her all this, she settles on surveillance, okay? She's followed at the high-risk clinic, and she's good. She goes. She's adherent. She declined any kind of prophylactic bilateral salpingoferectomy. She also declined tamoxifen that you didn't mention, but just keep that in mind for later. She wants another child, so she doesn't want to have that stuff. Okay, so then you see her in clinic after 3 years, okay? And then now there's a lesion that's found in the right breast. Because now you do this whole workup because there's a lesion. So she's got a T2 lesion, ER, PR positive, invasive ductal cancer, no lymphadenopathy. Okay? So what are you going to recommend now? Surgery, and what are you going to recommend?
So I'm a 43-year-old lady now with BRCA, known BRCA1 mutation that has a T2 hormone receptor positive invasive ductal carcinoma on surveillance.
Yep.
I suspect that it says the workup is complete, so her staging has been completed as well.
Correct.
There's no evidence of axillary disease.
Yep.
I would recommend that she undergo a mastectomy with a sentinel node, sentinel lymph node biopsy to stage her axilla, as well as a prophylactic contralateral mastectomy to reduce the risk of contralateral breast cancer in the future.
Okay. Sorry, it's not clicking very well. Just give me a second. Okay, so that's the end of that one. I think we covered all of that. Okay, feel good? Don't be nervous. You gotta. It's okay. You're doing okay. Okay, let's go to the next question. Okay, so we're forgetting about breast now. You're done. You saved your life. It's good. Okay, this is a little bit more. We'll take some time to read through it, okay? So it's a 65-year-old male. He comes in with right upper quadrant pain and jaundice. Okay? He's got a temp. Heart rate's up. You can see that blood pressure, 9155, white cell count's elevated, ALP is elevated, his bilirubin's up. Okay, the lipase is normal, his lactate, 2.5. So they did an ultrasound. The ultrasound shows there's a dilated extrahepatic ducts, and they're wondering about a stoma. Okay, this is his history. He's got atrial fibrillation. He's got a history of peptic ulcer disease. Okay, he's had previous enterectomy with Roux-en-Y. He's on beta blocker. Okay, so let's think about what's your management. This is how he presents. You just went down to see him.
Sure.
Okay.
So I have a 65-year-old gentleman who's presenting with fever, jaundice, and right upper quadrant pain, as well as evolving hemodynamic instability with tachycardia and hypotension. I would make sure that he's on appropriate monitors, including O2 saturation and a blood pressure cuff that's cycling regularly. I'd make sure he has 2 large bore IVs, and I would start him on crystalloid fluid resuscitation with 1 liter of Ringer's lactate and then a maintenance of Ringer's lactate at 150. I would also start him on broad spectrum antibiotics with piperacillin and tazobactam to address his cholangitis. Does not have an elevated lactate and does not have any evidence of end organ dysfunction, so I hope that this resuscitation will help address some of his instability. The past medical history of note is his previous Roux-en-Y reconstruction, which would make dealing with what sounds like a polydocal lithiasis with extrahepatic duct dilation and a common duct stone more challenging, because he would not be amenable to a straightforward ERCP. Once I've managed to start him on broad spectrum antibiotics, fluid resuscitate him, I would plan for an OR to do a common bile duct exploration, either transgastric or transcystic. I suspect he still has his gallbladder though.
Yes, he still has his gallbladder.
And he has a common duct stone with suspected cholangitis. And does he stabilize with my resuscitation?
He stabilizes. Let me just see. Can I just go to the next slide? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, he stabilizes. Yes.
So he stabilizes. So then my options are, we have to deal with this stone. Do we have ERCP available or someone that can do an advanced ERCP procedure like a rendezvous or something?
Yes, yeah. You have access to these things.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do we have IR available?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's good.
Okay, so if he didn't resuscitate, if he wasn't resuscitating very well, then...
Then I would take him to the operating room.
Okay. Okay.
Or sorry, I would take him to the IR suite for a PTC and drainage of his biliary system.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So let's move on. So, also consideration of ICU. Okay. Let's say this is what's happening now. Okay. I've changed. So he is. You start your resuscitation. He's on Tazo. You don't actually have access to endoscopy, okay. But I have to get you to say those things anyway. It's important to say that. But you have IR. To do that PTC, you did mention that, and they agreed to do this if you can correct the patient's coagulopathy, because it turns out he takes a blood thinner. He forgot to tell you that part. The guy didn't tell you, right? Patients forget this all the time. So now his INR is 2.5. Okay, so he does take a blood thinner. So now what are you going to do?
So I have a hemodynamically unstable patient who is. Anticoagulated with an INR of 2.5 and he needs an interventional procedure. So I would reverse him more acutely with FFP, and I would start by ordering 2 units of FFP and have them running on his way to IR to receive his PTC.
Okay, good. So...
Yeah. I'll also give him some vitamin K for this one.
Okay. Okay. So they're going to take him to the ICU because he's still not doing so great, but that's okay. You correct the INR, and then they do... the PTC, okay, and they decompress the biliary tree, okay, good job, they did everything, but they can't get past the stone, okay? It doesn't matter, the patient improves, okay, and then, hang on, this is just, I don't think, there's no question here, it's just letting you know what's happening. So you're going to do a repeat cholangiogram. Have you looked at a lot of cholangiograms?
No.
Okay, well, we already, this is what we're going to do, we're going to look at the cholangiogram. I can try to make this bigger if you like, but let's see. This will, I might wreck it, but let's see if that works.
That's okay, I can
okay,
see it.
You could see it, okay, but now I've like messed it up, so yeah, we'll go. It gives us a break, okay.
So I see both my intrahepatic and extrahepatic biliary system.
Yep.
There is filling of my cystic duct and gallbladder there as well, it looks like. I see occlusion of my common bile duct with a filling defect, but I also see some contrast going distal into the duodenum, so I suspect some the contrast is getting past the obstruction. It looks like the intrahepatic ductal dilation has resolved if he ever had that, although he only had extrahepatic in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So I do see a persistent common duct obstruction.
Yeah, we can see that there. That's good. Okay, so you can see there's a stone there. So you still don't have access to this advanced endoscopy, and IR can't get to the stone. Okay, now what do we do?
So now my options are... surgical removal of this stone. So my options are either laparoscopic or open, common bile duct exploration. And my laparoscopic options are either transgastric or transcystic. And my open option would be open common bile duct exploration and stone extraction.
Okay, let's see. I think you're supposed to... Okay, so... Okay, so we're waiting till the patient's stable, right? So then you had said that, I think. Maybe you didn't.
Maybe I didn't.
Okay, but that's okay. That's what you would... normally say. They're going to wait till they're stable. And that's good. We're okay. Don't worry. You're good. They don't have any abdominal anymore. Okay. But we know that you need to take them to the OR. So let's just describe the procedure. This is your open common bile duct
exploration. So I would position them supine with both arms out. I'd give them appropriate preoperative antibiotic therapy, SCD stockings, and pad all bony prominences. Prep and drape around them in the usual sterile fashion. Start by doing an upper midline laparotomy and place a fixed retractor like a Thompson Farthing. I would then start with exploring my right upper quadrant and begin with a open cholecystectomy.
Okay.
Once I've completed my cholecystectomy, I would identify I would identify my common bile duct and my protohepatitis to allow for appropriate mobilization and exposure before I begin my common bile duct exploration. Once I've isolated my common bile duct, I would make a vertical choledochotomy and extract the stone, if possible, using Fogarty catheters. If I am able to extract the stone, then I will...
Okay, what if Fogarty doesn't work? What else can you... So, give me some other ways to get this thing out.
I'll try to flush it down. I'll give them glucagon to see if that can help, yeah. In addition to the flush to help push the stone down. Fogarty doesn't work. And I can't...
Okay, I just wanted you to give me some other methods. So that's good. Okay, let's see. This is just a little bit more here, just because we're running out of time. So trial of your immunity, you couldn't get the stone out, okay? Still get stuck. So it feels impacted. Okay, what are you going to do now?
So a stone that's impacted at the ampulla, I would do a transduodenal sphincteroplasty for this patient. I would, if I was in a center that I had access to hepatobiliary surgical team, I would ask them to come in for an intraoperative consult to help with this procedure because it's something that I haven't done before and I'm not comfortable with.
Yep.
And then I would proceed with. I didn't think I was able to do it and the hepatobiliary surgery team was not there, then I would repair my choledochotomy over a T-tube, knowing that I had proximal drainage with my PTC, and I would send them off to a tertiary center for hepatobiliary to perform the procedure.
Okay, how do you make the duodenotomy? What's the direction or describe how you do it? I know you said you haven't done it, but
yeah,
just
no,
go
no
through
problem.
The steps of how you would do it.
It would be a... transverse duodenotomy, and I would close it in the opposite. It would be a horizontal duodenotomy that I would close transversely to reduce my risk of stricture there.
Okay, and where is the choledochotomy that's done inside there? Okay, I tried just getting you there.
Not between the vessels.
Is on. All right, so we are going to start with question one. So you are called to the emergency department for a 25-year-old male brought in by EMS after he sustained a stab wound to his left chest around the eighth rib. He is intoxicated. What is your initial management?
ABCs, so quick examination of the patient. Is his airway opened? Is he able to talk or not? While we're doing ABCs, I'd ask the nurses to get two large bore IVs, hook them up to monitors and oxygen. When I look at his airway, does he have a patent airway?
Yep, he's awake, he's talking.
He's awake, he's talking, breathing on his own. Uh-huh. CV circulation, so on the left side of the chest, eighth rib, we have spleen, lung. Is there an exit wound that we see or no? And there's no obvious gushing blood anywhere else?
No.
Okay. So I would want to finish the ABCs, get those lines and get them on the monitors, do a full head-to-toe exam, just quickly making sure there's no other missed injuries in the extremities, like the long bones, do a log roll, check his back, see if there's another injury that we've missed, and then get a chest x-ray in the trauma bay.
Okay, anything else?
Get a CT right if he seems stable as fully as on your way. Do we see any signs of, like when we're auscultating his lungs, are we hearing breath sounds on both sides?
Yeah, so you get them on the monitors. Your vitals are as follows. His heart rate's 120. Okay. His blood pressure's 125 on 75. You're setting 98% on 3 liters, and his GCS is 14. You find a single stab wound to the left anterior axillary line at the level of the 8th rib. Your FAST is equivocal, and your chest x-ray shows a left-sided hemothorax. What is the next step in your management?
I just place a chest tube on the left side for the hemothorax.
Okay. Describe how you're going to do that.
So patient is still maintaining his own airway. Line him supine while all of the material is being ready. I would also like anesthesia to be in the room. Localize the area, so for aiming for anterior axillary line, fourth intercostal space. So anesthetize him, make a vertical incision following the rib line, use Kelly's to palpate over top of the ribs and enter just directly over top of the ribs, avoid the neurovascular bundle, and then pop into the pleural space with the Kelly's, and then replace the Kelly with a finger and do a finger sweep 360 degrees to show that there's no lung stuck up to the pleura. And then place a large bore chest tube into that space, aiming apically, and then open the chest tube and put it onto suction.
Great, so you do that, you get 300 cc's of blood back right away, then it slows down, your patient's vitals improve, heart rate 105, trauma labs are all normal, your hemoglobin's 145, lactate's 2, alcohol level 24. What is the next step in your management?
So I'd want to put him on antibiotics and give him a tetanus shot. And then in terms of, do we have any additional information from police or EMS about what they found at the scene? Or
nothing more.
Just the alcohol level. We're on a full talk screen. In terms of just the area of this, because it's a little bit lower, I would want to take him to the CT scanner as long as his heart rate had improved and he was still maintaining his own airway. To take him to the CT scanner for a chest and abdomen pelvis CT scan with contrast.
Okay, so you do that, all you see is a residual small hemothorax. Patient's vitals are stable. There is some free fluid in the left upper quadrant. The chest tube has slowed down. What is the next step in your management?
Free fluid in the left upper quadrant. So if there's free fluid in the left upper quadrant, I would be concerned that there was a transition of this penetrating injury across the diaphragm, potentially into the spleen. So I'd want to put them for exploratory laparoscopy at the minimum, with the potential to open.
So you do that, you see blood in the left upper quadrant with active bleeding. You note a 2 cm hole in the left hemidiaphragm, and you notice an injury to the stomach on your laparoscopy. What's your next step?
So if I had the skill and felt confident with like laparoscopic suturing of the diaphragm, I would stay laparoscopic, but most likely open and do a full trauma laparotomy just to make sure that we haven't missed anything else. So exploring all four quadrants, making sure that there wasn't an injury to the spleen on that side that we couldn't see. And then in terms of the perforation or the hole in the stomach, depending on where it was, if it was really close and really lacerated, or if it's just like an in and out injury, to suture that close and match its momentum.
So it's on the greater curvature of the stomach. And what you see is on the anterior wall. Is there anything else you want to do?
I would check the posterior posterior wall.
So how are you going to do that?
So we'll go into the lesser sac and check the posterior wall of the stomach. I want anesthesia to place an ENT tube. If it reached the posterior wall, I'd be worried about the pancreas.
Okay, so you explore the lesser sac, you see both an anterior and posterior injury to the stomach, and you see a hematoma in the pancreas. How are you going to manage these injuries?
Is the hematoma going across the duct? Like, is it a full...
It's just in the tail of the pancreas.
Just in the tail of the pancreas. So I'd be worried about an injury to the duct, like the main duct of the pancreas. So do a distal pancreatectomy. If I wasn't confident that duct was 100% intact.
Is there anything else you can do?
I could leave a drain and have him get an MRI postoperatively to rule out a main branch injury, a main duct injury.
How are you going to repair the stomach?
So absorbable sutures, close the hole, and then patch it with cementum.
Okay, and how are you going to repair the diaphragm?
The diaphragm, non-absorbable sutures. Depending on how far away from the rib it is, either trying to reattach the diaphragm to the ribs or suturing the incision closed after fully washing out the chest.
Okay, so you fix that, you close him, you leave a drain for the pancreas. He's doing fine, chest tube's out. On post-op day 5, he becomes febrile and tachycardic, complaining of abdominal pain. What is your management?
So if he's hemodynamically stable and holding these pressures, I would want to get him to a CT scanner again. If he's not hemodynamically stable, then just go back to the OR for bleeding.
So your scan shows a left upper quadrant collection, which you percutaneously drain. Okay. Anything you're going to check for?
Lipase and amylase.
All right, so let's move on to the next question. So you are working in a peripheral hospital. You're called to the emergency department at 2 in the morning to see a 58-year-old male with hematemesis. It started at 6 p.m. that evening. It seems to be getting worse. He's feeling syncopal. His past medical history, he's on warfarin for atrial fibrillation. He's recently been using a lot of NSAIDs for back pain. His initial heart rate is 120, blood pressure 100 on 60. His hemoglobin is 80 and his INR is 2. He looks pale, but he's not peritonitic. What is your initial management?
Initial management would be resuscitation. So give him a liter of crystalloid, and type and screen him. So don't know how accurate that hemoglobin is. In terms of his INR, we could give him FFP. So I don't know if this community hospital has access to Octoplex, but if accessible, then we can give it. Differential for this, we're assuming, or most likely differential for this, with his history of NSAID use being on warfarin, the potential varices you'd worry about septic ulcer disease, duodenal ulceration. We have other medical history from him, like do we know what he was doing in the past couple days?
Just the fib on warfarin and the NSAID use for back pain.
Okay, and was he vomiting before he had hematemesis?
Started at 6 p.m. with hematemesis.
Just started at 6 p.m. Okay. I would see if we had endoscopy available at that hospital.
Right. Anything else you want to do before that?
How equipped is our hospital with blood transfusions? Do we have massive transfusion capabilities?
Okay, so you give him blood. And so you give them Octoplex, you give them 4 units of uncross-matched blood. They stabilize with respect to heart rate and blood pressure. And you give them a dose of erythromycin. So you are the only person there. So you take them to endoscopy. And in D1, you find this. Is your plan.
So that doesn't look like there's an active bleed there. So,
there's a bit visible. There's a visible vessel. I don't know how well it transmits. Okay. But.
See if we could inject it with epinephrine to stop the bleeding. If I could see an actual vessel coming out of me, then I could try to hemoclip it. I'd want to take biopsies of the area as well. Just
through there. Okay. So you clip it, you eject it, the patient actually settles. They do well overnight, but then overnight, in the next morning, you find that their hemoglobin dropped to the 60s. You give them blood, you resuscitate them. You take them back to endo, and you see an active bleeding vessel that you cannot control. Patient is now tachycardic, dropping their pressure. You are at a site that does not have interventional radiology. Okay. What is your plan?
So if we don't have interventional radiology analyzation, should we go to the OR for a laparotomy to see if we can access the vessel externally?
So describe your approach in the OR.
There's
no blood visible in the belly.
No blood visible in the belly. So up the midline laparotomy, you can mobilize the stomach and then feel the duodenum to see if we can feel that area that has a hematoma in it.
Any specific maneuvers you're going to do? It's in the first portion of the duodenum.
We could fully mobilize the duodenum. So if we took down the fat flexure and dissected along the duodenum to lift it up and immediately mobilize it so we can get better visualization.
Okay. So all the blood is intraluminal, so what's your next step?
take the anterior wall of the duodenum and make an incision along it, and then we're able to open it up and better visualize where the bleeding is coming from. Are we able to see that area?
Okay, so you do that, you make the longitudinal duodenotomy, and you see just blood.
Just blood. So do suction and compression to try to locate the exact area.
So you see the ulcer, you see the visible vessel, it's there, it's bleeding, you control the bleeding. So is there anything you can do to definitively manage that?
Definitively manage the bleeding?
This visible bleeding ulcer.
Okay. Other than resecting it?
Other than resecting it.
Can we inject with epi now that we can see it?
So you do that, but still it's bleeding. Still bleeding.
The clips aren't working?
No.
Okay.
Okay, so you actually end up putting in some U-stitches above and below, okay? And then the patient becomes jaundiced on post-op day two. What are you going to do? We'll just finish this question.
So we put in U-stitches. I would be afraid that we might have gone
just
through...
Give everyone a couple of minutes to wrap up, and then I think we can do a debrief together, and the staff can make a decision.
I'd be afraid we've gone through the posterior side and caught the common bile duct in that movement, and then basically constricted the common bile duct.
Okay, so how are you going to manage that? Their jaundice, their bilirubin's 100.
So I'd want, if I'm in a spot where I can get a PTC, we can drain it externally. If we can transfer them to hepatobiliary, because they will eventually need hepatobiliary reconstruction. The PTC would buy us time for draining their biliary tract, though, so if we get the PTC in them and transfer them to hepatobiliary. Because I don't think you'd be able to go through endoscopically and stent it open if it was a stitch.
Okay. We'll end the question there. Generally, you're going to stitch with dissolvable sutures.
Okay.
So they will dissolve.
They will dissolve?
Yeah.
Okay. You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear your thoughts, comments, and feedback. So send us an email at podcast.cjs@gmail.com. Or tweet at us at CanJSurge. Thanks again.